To the Show Brand, the inaugural podcast from myself, Adam Alter of the Razorback Nation, and Chris Bond, editor of Arkansas Sports 360. Chris, what are we doing here today?
Well, it's our weekly podcast. We hope to hit everybody with a little Razorback conversation. Not all Razorbacks, though. I think we like a little variety. We're going to spice it up a little bit. We'd like to give people an opportunity to listen at their convenience. You don't have to be parked by the radio at 1 o'clock or in your car at drive time. You can do whatever you want. Listen to it whenever.
There is good sports radio in the state. We're not here to discount that, but, hey, you can't always be by the radio when it's on with this. Hey, when you're walking your dog, when you're doing the dishes, whatever's convenient. We're bringing you what you want to hear. We're very accessible. Hit us up on Twitter. Follow Chris at C-Bahn. That's C-B-A-H-N. I'm Adam_Alter. That's Alter with an E-R. We're going to be putting this out there for you guys. Hope you enjoy it. Give us some feedback. Of course, we're talking Razorbacks, Chris. The news of the day before we get to the season opener is the announcement that Arkansas and Texas A&M will be renewing their series in Cowboy Stadium for quite a long time.
Yes, I like it in theory. I think with the alumni base that Arkansas has in Dallas, largest one outside the state of Arkansas, with the fact there are so many great recruits down there, there's money to be brought in from donors. Love the idea of having a presence in Dallas. It gets a little complicated, though, because basically, and I expect this to be on a T-shirt at some point, Jeff Long, every other year, four home conference games, three home stadiums, two states. How does that make that work?
It's very messy, and it brings in, you fold in the Little Rock argument, which is already heated enough, and now you're talking about, how are you only going to play two SEC games in Fayetteville if you're going to play one in Dallas and one in Little Rock? I mean, is that enough for what's supposed to be, of all your home stadiums, this is your real home stadium?
Yeah, and if you put together a schedule, maybe if you could get USC, if you could get Oklahoma to come play a home game, maybe you could justify two conference games. But if you're offering people who are paying thousands of dollars every year in donations and ticket fees, if you're giving them Jacksonville State and Tulsa.
Right. Now, the two conspiracy theories that I've read on this are, one, this is the next step in eliminating Little Rock as a regular thing, at least for SEC games, or two, this is the first notion that the SEC will be going to a 9-game schedule starting in 2014. Do you subscribe to either of those?
Can it be a little of both?
Perhaps.
I'm sure it was purely coincidental, but the same day, well, within 24 hours of War Memorial sending out a release about Louisiana Monroe tickets, they're now going to bring them to the fans. They're going to sell them at road shows in Searcy and Conway and Cabot. And within 24 hours, Arkansas announces its deal with Dallas. It was good timing on the university's part because I think it helped strengthen their argument if they ever wanted to make that move when the Little Rock contract expires. I foresee a day when there's one game in Little Rock. It's a non-conference game, an attractive non-conference game.
How attractive? What's attractive to you?
I think as long as you have a BCS conference opponent.
Duke is a BCS conference opponent. Is that attractive?
It's more attractive than Louisiana Monroe.
Is it? I'm not sure Louisiana Monroe wouldn't beat Duke.
Well, okay. Yeah, you're probably right there. But I think the days of 1AA, New Mexico State, stuff like that, those have to end if you only give Little Rock one game. We'll see. I mean, we'll see what happens. I think people in Little Rock are certainly nervous. The folks in Northeast Arkansas are beginning to see this maybe as their opportunity to swoop in and have a game in Little Rock. So it's going to be interesting to watch the politics of this all play out over the next year. Now, what alleviates all this is if the SEC goes to a 9-game schedule, then you don't have this problem. Arkansas has enough inventory for its home stadium, its real home stadium. Sorry, Little Rock. Sorry, Dallas. So because of TV, because they need more attractive games to sell to advertisers, because the other leagues are going to 9-game schedules, I think the SEC has to do this at some point. And that would help Arkansas, although I hope it doesn't happen, because I love the idea of four home games, three home stadiums, two states.
I am a firm believer that college football should be played on college campuses, with one caveat. Only when you can play somewhere that will be especially beneficial to your program. Playing somewhere like Cowboy Stadium, brings that to the table. Playing at War Memorial does not. Now, that may not be a popular opinion all around this state. I know there's a lot of people in Central and Southern Arkansas that are very, very passionate about keeping a Razorback presence at War Memorial Stadium. Sorry, I disagree. I love that they're continuing at Cowboy Stadium. I do not like that it's a conference opponent. I believe conference games, which matter more, should be split home and home, give everybody an equal advantage. Now, if you can tell me that this same deal at Cowboy Stadium, which runs through whatever it is, 2024, is with TCU or Oklahoma State or something like that, which would be a very sexy non-con game in a very sexy stadium, love it. I don't like playing a conference opponent at a neutral site. What do you think?
I don't mind playing a conference opponent. Here's the maybe wisdom behind it for Arkansas and A&M. They have eliminated travel time for conference games. It's not as far from Fayetteville to Dallas as it is from Fayetteville to College Station. Much closer College Station to Dallas than College Station to Fayetteville. So you've eliminated that. That gives you a little bit of a benefit. Both of those programs heavily involved in recruiting Dallas and the Dallas area. They need a presence there. They need to be in the Dallas Morning News. They need to be on Randy Galloway's talk show and all that stuff in Dallas. They need to be on the ticket. So I think it's a smart move from that. I understand what you're saying. It would be better if it was an Alabama-Michigan situation. I think, you know, if it was a non-conference game, maybe to kick off the year. But I think it makes sense for Arkansas and A&M. The one thing I want to back up, Dallas today, 2012, makes more sense. I can't believe I'm about to say this out loud. Dallas in 2012 makes more sense to the University of Arkansas than Little Rock does.
I don't disagree with that.
However, the history of the University of Arkansas, I mean, I've lived in the state, but I moved up here about 10 years ago, right about the time they opened 540. That made getting here from other parts of the state so much easier instead of having to go up the Pig Trail or go up 71 with these, you know, big 18-wheelers going 70 miles an hour, running you off the road, down the side of the mountain. It's a lot easier now. You can get from Dumas to here a lot better. But historically, you had to take the game to the people in Central Arkansas. I think there's still a marketing value there. If you drive around Little Rock, there are ASU billboards, there are UCA billboards, Boll Weevil billboards from UAM. Arkansas doesn't have to do that because they play football games down there. And I think if you can do one game a year, I think you get the marketing value and you don't wind up screwing your fans in Fayetteville.
Let me take that point a step further. Here's why Dallas is more important than Little Rock. Because Arkansas doesn't need to play in Little Rock to attract the recruits from that area. There already are Kansans. They're already paying attention to the Razorbacks, and odds are they're already going to Fayetteville to watch them in person. Texas is one of the three best recruiting states in this country. To win at a high level in college football, you need to be able to recruit either California, Florida, or Texas. Arkansas has to recruit Texas. Getting A&M into the league helps that. Playing in Cowboy Stadium helps that even more, especially now that they can host recruits there. That is a new rule starting, I believe, this year.
Yeah, A&M and Arkansas join together. I mean, make no mistake, they're going to be competing for recruits. They're going to be competing for wins. They joined together at the annual meetings this year in Destin, and they brought this
Destiny is more like it. Destiny.
That was terrible. They brought this legislation before the SEC. They got, I guess, maybe Florida and Georgia got on board with them because they play an off-campus game. So they were really smart in doing this, getting this legislation pushed through so they can host unofficial visits in Cowboy Stadium, because otherwise there's zero benefit to having that game down there. You have to be able to host recruits. You got to be able to get them tickets.
I wouldn't say zero. People are still seeing it.
From a recruiting standpoint, though, you want to be able to have the players there. You want to be able to with whatever within the rules. I don't know what all the rules are. I don't know what you're allowed to do with unofficial visitors. But you don't want the players in Dallas watching on TV. You don't want them having to stand outside the stadium and buy one of those $10 tickets to watch it on the big screen.
Certainly not if you could be there on the sidelines and see it in person. Sure.
So this is the benefit to that. I think it's a big win for the program. I think it's a potential loss for Little Rock.
I'm thinking it's probably more than potential. I think Jeff Long has been driving that direction for quite a while now. We're in agreement. We're in agreement. Playing Cowboy Stadium is a huge benefit. This is a great boon for the university. We just disagree about who they should be playing there. At this point, that's kind of beside the point. You're listening to The Showgram. This is the very first Showgram podcast from the Razorback Nation's Adam Alter and Arkansas Sports 360's Chris Bohn. We're talking Razorback football right now. We've been discussing playing in Dallas, but that's for the future. The more, much more immediate future is this season, which starts in just a few days against Jacksonville State. It's going to be a slaughter, presumably, Chris. So assuming it goes out that way, what are you looking for? What should the fans be looking for and wanting to see out of this game?
I think if you're fans, if you're coaches, if you're players, you've got to be watching the offensive and defensive lines. You want to know, is this defensive line as strong as it's supposed to be? Are they going to be able to get pressure on the quarterback and make the rest of the defense look better? And the offensive line, can they get push up front? Can they create running lanes? Can they protect Tyler Wilson? We saw even in those early, what Steve Caldwell calls preseason games last year, we saw in those Tyler Wilson got beat up. Even in those games, the offensive line provided zero push. That the whole offensive success this season, beating Alabama, beating LSU, is predicated on can they provide that up front. And if they're getting their butts whipped against Jacksonville State, whoever, they're going to be in trouble.
I agree with you on the O-line. It's very important. Tyler Wilson took no less than a beating last year behind that line. Now, there's three new starters, but at the same time, there's a lot more experience on the O-line. Obviously, Bailey and Swanson bring tons of experience, but the guys that they were working in as starters or key contributors last year were either a true freshman like Mitch Smothers or Bray Cook or a first-year transfer student like a Jason Peacock. All those guys are going to play again with a year in the SEC under their belt. You know, guys like David Hurd and Tyler Deacon, they're starting. They're former walk-ons, but, you know, I talked to Travis Swanson about this after practice on Tuesday. You know, I asked him about how they're doing, and he says, you know, everyone wants to point at them saying, yeah, they're former walk-ons, can they really hack it? And he's like, yes, they can do this. I've been watching them do it every day. Do you believe that?
I do because of this. The two, I won't say the two best, but two of the best all-time offensive linemen in Arkansas history, walk-on Brandon Burlesworth, who wound up being an NFL draft pick and an All-American, and Mitch Petras, who had starting time with the NFL Giants, with the New York Giants in the NFL last year.
And he started as a fullback and played some linebacker.
Yeah. Now, sometimes you get a highly heralded guy like a Sean Andrews who comes in, basically from the word go, starts, dominates, has a beautiful career. Sometimes you get a guy like a Petras, like Burlesworth, even, you know, Jason Peters, who comes in as a tight end and primarily played tight end, but, you know, they used him essentially as another offensive lineman. I mean, those kind of guys can develop into something. Offensive linemen are a little bit late bloomers sometimes. They can be, I think, as a general rule. Your skill position people, if a guy comes in and he has to redshirt and he hadn't done it by a second or third year, he's probably not going to do it. Offensive linemen are just a little different breed, and you can have a guy who's a slow developer who it comes on for him in his fourth or fifth year in the system.
We're talking about Ronnie Wingo there, about guys that maybe they just don't have it?
I was talking about just...
No,
because look, if you look at what Wingo has done, he has produced.
Has he produced as a running back?
He has produced in ways other than Niall Davis has, but he has produced.
What does that mean?
Ronnie so far has not been. He has not had the burst at the line of scrimmage. He's not been a guy that averages 6 yards a carry or 4 yards a carry, but he's been very productive in the passing game. They don't win that A&M game without him last year, catching a pass, leveling a defender at the goal line.
Leveling might be a bit strong. He shook the tackle. He broke the tackle. He didn't bowl them over.
Yeah, I think he did. But that, we'll go to the tape. That's okay, though. Look, point is, let's get this back on track. I mean, you're trying to – who knows what you're trying to do.
Am I baiting you? Are we fishing?
I like Wingo, by the way. I think he'll have a good year this year. People will be pleased with him, I think, before it's all said and done. But unlike skill position guys – offensive linemen can take time to develop, and become something. So that's the hope that I have for these two walk-on offensive linemen. I'm not guaranteeing it. I'm just saying it's more possible than if you were having to put, say, a walk-on fifth-year guy quarterback.
Joe Cox type kid at Georgia tore him up here in Fayetteville. Besides the point, I do like that Wingo's working at wide receiver. I think he's more suited out there. He needs some space to build up some speed. His acceleration just isn't enough from the 7 yards behind the line, taking a handoff. And he just doesn't change direction very fast. It looks like he's trying to wind himself in a new direction, and by that time he's tackled. You touched on the D-line. I'm not so worried about the D-line. There's so many productive bodies there. There are way bigger question marks behind the defensive line. Starting at linebacker, we need, you know, maybe Tank Wright is more natural at linebacker than he is at D-end. He's kind of bounced back and forth there a few times. I'd like to see it to believe it. Kiaro Small is lining up right behind him as the second on the depth chart. Then you know a couple of true freshmen are going to play, and Otha Peters and A.J. Turner. You know, you're working in new guys like Jarrett Lake and some old guys who haven't played a ton, like Matt Marshall and T. Will, Terrell Williams. The linebackers are full of question marks.
Yeah, there are definitely questions there. The biggest question to me is, you think you have two guys that you know their productivity and what they can do there. Alonzo Highsmith comes back as a leading tackler from last year, looked like an all-SEC player at linebacker. Tank Wright has linebacker in his history, you know, came in as a linebacker, was a really good defensive lineman. We have no idea how those guys are going to work together. The whole Tank Wright to linebacker experiment happened because Highsmith gets hurt in the spring. Then you bring him in, they get like a minute and a half on the field together, and Highsmith gets hurt. Then Nile Davis, you know, levels Tank Wright and gives him what John L. Smith will only describe as a head injury. So Tank has been limited. We have not seen those two guys together. They have great rapport off the field. They're good friends. How does that translate onto the field? And that's something that we have to see this weekend and in the next couple of weeks. And what is there behind them? Is a fullback converting a linebacker? Is that enough depth? Is an Otha Peters and A.J. Turner who physically can do it but don't really have a clue of what they're doing? And that's just how it goes with freshmen. Are those guys going to be able to provide valuable snaps? I don't know.
I believe Otha Peters will come in and contribute almost from the word go. He's got a man's body at 18 or 19 years old, however old he is. He looks physically prepared to take on SEC caliber opponents. Certainly between the ears, there's going to be a learning curve for him. I just believe his physical attributes will overcome that to an extent. I don't know if I can say the same about A.J. Turner. He certainly needs to bulk up a little bit more. Now, he doesn't play the middle like Otha does. He plays on the outside. But these are two guys that are both going to play pretty significant minutes as true freshmen in a very important year in Razorback football.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is they have to have those guys on the field. It's just, do they have them on the field and they're productive, or do they have them on the field and they don't get anything out of them? Because we've seen that before, them force, you know, freshmen into duty there. Terrell Williams comes to mind from a few years ago. He was put on the field because of injuries and a suspension to Jerry Franklin.
Franklin got kicked out of the Georgia game, and the Bulldogs tore apart everyone that Williams was covering.
Yeah, I mean, and they picked on him. They were aware enough to know, hey, this guy's a true freshman. I think that stunted his development to some level. I think he went inside because he had looked great in practice, and I think he went inside a shell after that. So you're going to put freshmen out there at this linebacker position. You just have to have them produce. Another guy, and I hesitate to bring him into the linebacker conversation because he's kind of outside linebacker. He's kind of a safety. Jarrett Lake, they really like what they've gotten out of him in practice. Coaches finally quit trying to get him to gain weight. And I can relate to that, man. I was a kid in high school, you know, wearing like my size 28 pants or whatever, and I wanted to get bigger, and people were like, hey, man, you need to drink milkshakes and eat ice cream every day, and it just didn't happen. It's happening now. I'm kind of big now in the middle, but
getting big for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, but, I mean, they finally quit trying to force food down Jarrett Lake's throat and just said, you know what, this guy's got some athletic ability. He's got some instinct. Let's stick him on the field and let him play. He's small, but we'll see how is he able to help them. I have a feeling he'll be able to make some plays this year.
He strikes me as the type of kid that is more just an instinct. Just put me out there. I'll make plays. Don't bog me down too much with you need to be here for this and there for that. He's kind of playing that same position Jericho Nelson's played through the years. Ross Rasner, kind of that hybrid linebacker safety position. Rasner's playing more of that this year, although he's playing a little bit more true strong safety. But I believe in Jarrett Lake. This is a guy that Oklahoma wanted, and Oklahoma doesn't just go after anybody. And the only reason they backed off of him is because he had some injuries as a senior in high school, and he's had some academic issues. And once he cleaned that up, Oklahoma had backed off, and Arkansas swooped in. I think this guy could be a playmaker.
Yeah, I like Lake. I mean, I think he's got, again, that athleticism. I think he's got some instinctive ability at the position. I think part of the problem for him, too, as a younger player, was learning the scheme, trying to figure out what the former defensive coordinator wanted out of everybody. But he's the perfect example of kind of the new attitude with this defensive staff. They've simplified things. Doesn't mean it's all easy, but they've simplified it. They've changed terminology to where the players can digest it easier, and they're big believers in getting their best athletes on the field and letting them go make plays and not worrying about they didn't know this in a meeting or they screwed this up. This defensive staff just has a different approach. You can see it with the defense, and that's why a guy like Jarrett Lake's on the field, and I suspect we'll see him make some plays this year.
Since when did Willie Robinson turn into Voldemort? He's like he who shall not be named now. It's always the former coordinator, the guy who was here before. He got fired because he didn't do his job. I mean, can we not say Willie Robinson?
Yeah, we could say Willie Robinson. It's just we're into this 2012 season. I didn't want to spend a whole lot of time. Willie Robinson here, Reggie Johnson, I'll go ahead and mention him too. Bobby Petrino, we'll go ahead and mention him. Garrick McGee's not here.
Jessica Durrell.
Jessica Durrell's not here anymore. I mean, we could go through the list of people on the staff that aren't here anymore. I just didn't see any reason to open that box.
From now on, Willie Robinson is Voldemort for every podcast going forward.
Let me add this real quick about the defense, though. Willie struggled communicating with his players, but we have
Willie struggled communicating with everybody.
Okay, fair enough. But we have also learned in preseason camp from offensive guys, from defensive guys, completely we weren't going after this. They just offered this. They said, look, defensive players were not allowed to make plays on the ball in practice. They got chewed out if a defensive back broke up a pass, intercepted a pass in practice. So, yeah, Willie had his issues, but maybe it wasn't all on him.
No. Bobby Petrino was at the level of a Nick Saban when it comes to control of everything that happens, if not more so than a guy like Nick Saban, and it all slanted towards the offense. You're right. We weren't trying to find this story, and I say we as in all the reporters who cover this team. We're just two of them. They offered that information up to us. Everything angled towards the offense in scrimmages, in practices, because that's what Bobby knows best. That's what Bobby wants to succeed. That's where he has made his living. Now, I don't think that's the case anymore. I think it's much more on an even keel. And, you know, same thing with Voldemort's former defense. They're the ones that told us how complicated it was, how they were so limited on doing things at times. And like you said, Paul Haynes has come in and simplified things in a good way, not a bad way. And they just keep talking about points A and B, strong up front, stop the run. If they can't do that against Jacksonville State, they certainly can't do it against Alabama in week 3.
No, that's the thing. A lot of people just laugh when people say, well, I don't expect anything out of this game. There's nothing you can look for. Yeah, there are. I mean, can they stop the run? Can they tackle? It looked like they were better at tackling against Kansas State. Will that carry over? Because if they're not tackling, if they're not stopping the run against Jacksonville State, Alabama, LSU,
be a bloodbath.
A&M, they're going to be in big trouble. Bloodbath, that was a nice, succinct way to put it.
We've talked linebackers. Let's go back to the secondary because I honestly believe this. The most important person on this team when it comes to how much success they will enjoy in 2012 might be Darius Winston or whoever ends up winning that cornerback job opposite of Tevin Mitchell because I love Tevin Mitchell. I think this kid is great. I think he is in for big, big things, and Chris, you and I have talked about this before. The SEC does not have a whole lot of dominant receivers like they've had in years past. There's no Julio Jones. There's no A.J. Green. There's no Alshon Jeffrey. And now there's not even a Derrick Rogers from Tennessee who's gone, even though Arkansas doesn't play Tennessee this year. Do they? No, they don't.
No, and I'm really – thank you, A&M and Missouri, for screwing me out of a trip to Knoxville, which is a really beautiful place. I was really looking forward to that trip, so I will forever hold a grudge against the Aggies and Tigers for screwing me out of that trip. Anyway, as you were saying, Tennessee, no Derrick Rogers. There are no really – outside of Arkansas, there's no big physical dominant wide receivers in the league. So, Tevin Mitchell.
Yeah, I mean – Ryan Swope, I mean, he's probably the next best guy outside of Kobe Hamilton, Swope from Texas A&M. So if you can match up Mitchell on whoever the other team's best guy is, whoever they're playing week to week, and he can tilt the field and take that guy away and limit him to two or three catches and no touchdowns, tilt the field all the way over there, it puts a lot of pressure on whoever's over there. And I'm not sure Darius Winston, or as I like to call him, five-starius Winston, is up to the task. This is his fourth year in the program, and he's done almost nothing to impress me. Literally, maybe less than nothing.
He's struggled, especially for a kid that came in so heralded with so much hype behind him. You know, when you look at this secondary last year, they had one interception last year, Adam, and that was from Greg Gatson. Greg Gatson, who, by the way, is continuing to stick with the San Diego Chargers, believe it or not, doing really well for them. So they had one interception last year. Winston definitely struggled. He has struggled since he got here. If you are looking for reasons to believe that this will be the year for him, I go back to things being simplified, the new coaching staff communicating better with players. I think Darius has a better rapport with Bobby Allen than he had with Willie Robinson, whose name I nearly forgot.
Voldemort.
Yes. Also, Winston is stronger. He finally was able to put on some weight. He's not as afraid to stop the run and get in there and mix it up with tackles and things of that sort. So maybe I'm just saying, if you're shaking your head at me,
you can go glass half full all you want. To me, this ship has sailed.
There is a reason that Arkansas, Clemson, Georgia, Miami, Michigan, Tennessee, there's a reason that these schools were after him. And
yeah, but would they offer him a transfer spot right now?
Would they offer him a transfer spot now? No.
Exactly.
No.
Look, lots of kids have great offers out of high school. He's not lived up to this, and time is almost out.
No, time is out.
Time is out. You're on my – oh, good. We agree then.
I agree with you. Like, if it doesn't happen within the first few games of this year, it's not going to happen.
Because you know what? When I watch Kalon Kellybrew, I watch him make plays. I see him get something done. When I watch Davion McKinney and Will Hines, a redshirt freshman and a true freshman, I see a whole lot of potential. I see big, but bigger than Darius. You talked about Darius. These kids are bigger than Darius. And I think they could bring a lot more to the table than somebody who he's old and he's got one of those old faces, you know, like Greg Oden. He looks like an old man already.
Darius?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, yeah, yeah. He looks like they have to call. We need to ask about this. They have to call him Grandpa. I mean, they have to. He's been around, and he's just got that. He looks weathered. Like he's just been. He looks like he's. You know what, though? He's probably lived some life. Like, he's from Helena, and that's...
Helena?
That's an interesting place down there. So, he's lived some life, man. He's haggard, I'm sure. I wish I could grow an old man beard, though. That would be.
I just wish I could grow a beard at all.
Oh, you either?
No, I can't grow a beard.
I can't either.
Yeah, we're pathetic. I'm about to be a father, too. Jeez. But we're way off topic. Do you agree with me that spot could maybe be the most important spot on the defense because of what I believe Tevin Mitchell can get done on the other side of the field?
I don't know if I agree with you that it's the most important spot. I'm far more interested probably in the linebackers because I have a firm belief that if the defensive line is able to get pressure the way we think they're all going to get pressure, if they're going to be able to stop the run, I think that is going to put the corners in better positions to make plays. I just think the defense, I think a lot of corner play, especially with the way Tevin seems to be able to maybe lock guys down, I think a lot of how that other guy operates, it's going to depend on how good he is, but it also depends on what the defensive line is able to do. So, and they're so terribly thin at linebacker, it looks like. So I'm far more interested in linebacker, maybe.
You're listening to The Show, Graham, the inaugural podcast from Chris Bond, editor of Arkansas Sports 360, and myself, Adam Alter, assistant sports director at the Razorback Nation, KNWA and KARK. It's interesting, Chris, that when we talked about what we're looking for in game one, both of us brought up things on defense. Now, we both agree this offense is going to be pretty good, but there certainly are things to see. How much is Nile going to play on Saturday? Because I'll eat my hat if he's on the field in the second half.
You want to set the over-under at like 12 carries? Or does that even seem high?
I certainly think he'll no way he gets more than 15. No way.
We'll set it at 12, and I'll take the under.
Okay.
What do you want? You think he goes under or over 12?
Yeah, I'm probably... Really push. 12 on the nose.
Oh, that's so lame.
Probably under. I didn't want to agree with you, but you're probably right.
Just go with the push. Take the coward's way out. That's fine. Here's the thing, and this was interesting because we've been hounding John L. Smith and the players and Nile, trying to figure out how much contact was he going to get, why did he get contact in the mock game, which Nile pushed for, by the way. But a little insight from John L. Smith. He admitted today in 2011 there was an internal conversation on the coaching staff about whether or not to get Nile hit. They were strongly considering letting him go through. Look, he ran for 1,300 yards and 13 touchdowns.
In basically seven games.
Right. Knew the offense, one of their best players. Their philosophy, get the good guys to the game. They balked on that. They put him out there for contact. First hit, he breaks his ankle, shatters his ankle, and a whole bunch of other stuff that I'm not smart enough to know medically what happened. But he screwed up his ankle. That's why they were so cautious with him this year, because they had the conversation, they agreed, we probably don't need to get him out there that much, and they went against their better judgment and ruined his season. That's why they were cautious with him, and that's why I suspect they'll continue to be cautious with him until Alabama, when he'll be fresh and he'll run for hundreds of yards and all the touchdowns.
Maybe. I mean, no. I certainly believe Nile's ready to go. I do believe that. And when you talk to his teammates, and we've talked to just about every darn one of them trying to get any tidbits of information we can about Nile Davis, and they all swear up and down, he not only is he back, they're arguing he's better than ever. And the little bits we have got to see him even just make burst from behind the line, every time he touches the ball, it looks like he gets fired out of a cannon. And he's built like a brick house. So I don't know. Part of me worries about fumbling. Part of me worries about, you know, sometimes when you treat something with too much kid gloves, it blows up the other way. You know, maybe he's not ready to go out there and he gets hurt again because he didn't get hurt. I don't know. I mean, you could make the argument any way, shape, or form. I just don't think there's any reason to throw him out there on Saturday any more than you absolutely need to satisfy the fans, which, frankly, is probably 10 carries.
You have now I'm so confused by your position on this. You wanted him hit.
He got hit.
You wanted more contact in practice.
I did.
Because you're worried about fumbles. But then when it comes to the actual game, you don't want him taking hits. Because you're worried about what?
Because here's why. I trust Arkansas's defense in practice to safely tackle him more than I trust an opponent who, you know, we talked about somebody wants to make their name because I laid out Nile Davis. You're not going to find that guy in a Razorback uniform. You're going to find that guy in a Jacksonville State uniform or an Alabama uniform or a whatnot. So, yes, it may sound hypocritical, but there's methods to my madness.
Okay, if you say so. But the bottom line is we're going to see him. He's going to start. He's going to look fantastic. If you have not watched practice, and all you needed was one practice without contact, I swear to you, to watch him hit the hole and watch him sprint down the field, if he stays healthy, and if this offensive line with the walk-ons and the changes there, if they can provide any sort of push, I think he is going to have a monster year. Now, there are a lot of variables, but I firmly believe And I didn't know this. I didn't know this before camp. If you put me on the spot and you said Nile Davis or Tyler Wilson, who's the most likely to win the Heisman Trophy this year? I would have to go with Nile Davis right now, which is ridiculous because Tyler Wilson was incomplete on four passes over the last 15 months. Okay, in practice, he was never incomplete. He's looked unbelievable. I just think Nile has he has been. I don't even have the words for it. Am I crazy?
No, but what is kind of crazy is how, you know, when he was coming back, there was lots of talk about, oh, Nile's going to be back, and Nile's going to do this, and Nile's going to do that, not just from local media, but from national media. Over the last month, Nile has become very under the radar. Everybody loves to talk about Marcus Lattimore from South Carolina. Now, don't get me wrong, Marcus Lattimore is a tremendous running back who's got a very bright future and is probably going to have a great year for South Carolina, but to everybody, it's become, well, I mean, to everybody, when I say everybody, I mean a lot of the national media that I pay attention to. As far as the SEC hierarchy, it's a clear Lattimore 1 and a Nile Davis 2, and I don't think that's fair. They're both coming off of an injury. They both had a huge 2010, although Nile had a better 2010, in my opinion. Why is that happening?
Nile is one of many weapons that Arkansas presumably has. So you'll see him one game, he'll run for 100, but the receivers will have a big weekend. Other weeks, he'll run for 200, the receivers will be quiet. They have a lot of weapons. South Carolina, I'm not convinced, has that many weapons on offense, so people know. Now, that's counterintuitive because you would think, well, if you only have one weapon, everybody's going to gear up to stop him. Well, that didn't work out so well for most of South Carolina's opponents. So I think Nile somewhat gets lost in the shuffle. And I also think this, and yeah, Marcus Lattimore was injured last year. But before he went out, he ran for over 800 yards. He was on his way to another 1,000-yard season. We have, with Marcus Lattimore, we have a season and a half body of work. With Nile Davis, and I am on record, I mean, rewind this thing. I just said I think he's in for a monster year, potentially, if things line up the way they're supposed to.
Right.
We have a 7-game body of work for Nile Davis. Now, it's not his fault that he only got 6 carries for 40 yards against Alabama in 2010 when they should have won that game had they had any running threat whatsoever. That's on the former coach. That's not on Nile.
Yeah, they had Broderick Green.
Yeah.
Well, no. You know, if you need a yard, Broderick will get you a yard. If you need 2 yards, Broderick will get you a yard. But they kept playing him.
Yeah, I don't, you know, whatever. So, but that's water under the bridge. I mean, but look, I just think there's more of a body of work for Marcus Lattimore. Also, Marcus Lattimore, I don't have their schedule in front of me. I'm trying to remember, they play LSU?
They avoid one of them between Alabama and LSU. They avoid one of them, and they host Georgia. And so, yeah, their schedule lines up a lot easier than Arkansas's.
So that's my point. Nile Davis gets to face Alabama. He gets to face LSU. He gets to face Texas A&M. Meanwhile, you know, South Carolina avoids they play at LSU.
But they don't play Alabama at all.
They don't play Alabama at all. They get Arkansas at home.
Georgia at home.
So I just think the schedule sets up easier for them. And I think that's another reason maybe Nile is not maybe he's under the radar a little bit, which seems crazy to say, but I agree with you. I think he's a little under the radar right now, and I think those are the reasons. I think the body of work is not there. I think he's got a more difficult schedule, and I think Arkansas has more weapons.
Here's my bold prediction for game one. Jonathan Williams will lead the Razorbacks in rushing. True freshman who, frankly, coming into the year was almost a guarantee to get a redshirt with 3 senior running backs ahead of him on the depth chart. Played so well in camp, so well in the scrimmages, they couldn't stomach putting a red shirt on this kid. And if you went to any of the scrimmages, you saw why. This guy is the real deal. He ran way better than Ronnie Wingo. You know, he ran better than pretty much anybody because Nile didn't touch the ball very much. This kid's really good, and he's going to get a lot of carries in garbage time on Saturday.
Yeah, I could see that. I like Jonathan Williams. I think we may see him on special teams. Maybe he and or Nate Holmes in a punt return situation. They like Dennis Johnson there, but as John L. Smith has pointed out, Dennis is going to help them in other ways. Dennis is older. They need to develop some younger players. They need to get a guy like Jonathan Williams the experience. So look for him. I agree with you. I look for him to have a big game. My kind of breakout star, I think, against Jacksonville State, if there can be such a thing, I'm also going with a freshman. I think Mikel McKay, I don't want to put a handicap on catches, number of receiving yards. I think he'll have two touchdowns. I think you'll see him posting guys up like he's, you know, on the block in basketball.
Which he does play. And, I mean, what a steal. This was literally the last recruit as part of this recruiting class. A throw-in to fill in some numbers almost. I mean, Bobby didn't seem like he even wanted him and just almost took him out of spite. And now here he is starting at wide receiver as a true freshman.
Well, basically, he was on their radar on some level, but was also considering basketball. Dorial Green-Beckham, who's second-team tight end at Missouri right now. Uh-huh.
Really? Yeah. Tight end?
Really, depth chart. He's the number two tight end.
Not playing receiver at all?
I think he'll play receiver, but for now, he's number two on the depth. I mean, you know how depth charts go, pre-game depth charts.
Gary Pinkle. All right.
But I think basically it was you had the number one recruit in the country, a 6'5", basketball-playing, super athletic receiver who's choosing between you and Missouri. He goes to Missouri, so your backup plan is a 6'6", really athletic basketball player who also happens to play receiver. And it has worked out really well for them so far. I could see McKay having a nice year.
Let me get your opinion on this, because I've been going with this line of questioning at all the media opportunities this week, because I'm not sure this year's set of pass catchers has the ability to stretch the field like we've seen from Arkansas in the last few years with Greg Childs and Joe Adams and Jarius Wright. Kobe Hamilton's got plenty of speed, don't get me wrong, but I just really believe he's going to be almost double-teamed all the time. Chris Gregg's got great speed, but he's got great speed for a tight end. He doesn't have great speed for a receiver. And then you got guys like Brandon Mitchell and Mikhail McKay, and you know, if you want to go further down the line, Julian Horton. You know, none of those guys have proven to have breakaway speed. They're great receivers. They're big bodies that you could really just march down the field, putting it between their numbers over and over and over. But I don't know if we're going to see the 60-yard bombs we saw last year.
It'll be more difficult. The good thing, I mean, Kobe Hamilton has all of it. He's got size, and he does have that speed and ability to stretch the field. You don't normally see the speed to stretch the field that Chris Gregg has at tight end, so they'll stretch the field a little bit from the tight end position. Demetrius Wilson, he has some speed. He could be a guy. But the bottom line is you're looking at a starting lineup of wide receivers, 6'4", 230-pound Brandon Mitchell, 6'3", 210-pound Kobe Hamilton, 6'6", 190, Mikel McKay. You've got some plus Gregg, a tight end who's humongous. You have really big bodies out there. And I talked to Brandon Mitchell about this at practice the other night, because remember, he's a guy that played quarterback for 3 years. And I said, Brandon, put your quarterback hat on for a minute. What's it like to be drop back in the pocket, scan the field, and be looking at 6'3", 6'4", and 6'6"? And he said, it's great. Yeah, maybe they don't have the ability to stretch the field the way a Joe or a Jarius did, but they're going to body up with defensive backs. They're going to be able to essentially post them up. And Brandon said typically those taller guys have great wingspans. You have margin of error as a quarterback because they have the wingspan and they can go up and get it. So he really, you know, as a quarterback, you've got to like being able to look out there and seeing those big bodies.
But even if we're not going to see the two-play drives that, you know, Bobby kind of hung his hat on, this is a great situation for this offense to be very dynamic, because you have a quarterback who not only has tremendous accuracy like Tyler Wilson, he's proven that he'll throw the ball to whoever's open. He's not playing favorites out there. So when you have this many big bodies that can get some space, and you don't need a ton of space with their long arms and whatnot, I think Tyler could be putting up some huge accuracy numbers this season. On the spot, ready? This is a segment we call On the Spot. Chris has no idea what I'm about to ask him, and vice versa, he's going to ask me something. Chris, tell me a story of when you asked something to a coach that he did not like and he barked at you.
Asked something of a coach that he did not like and he barked at
you. Jump down your throat.
Oh, my gosh, man. This is tough. This is on the spot. completely unprepared for this. He didn't bark at me, but John L. did start out his inaugural press conference reminding me not to ask stupid questions. which was all in fun, but I think he had heard me ask questions before, so he knew where I was coming from. Man, I know I ticked Bobby Petrino off a couple times. I can't think of any specifics. I do know the very first story that I ever wrote about Bobby being here. If you remember when he came from Atlanta, his former players were calling him cowards, but there were still people calling him an offensive genius, and so the first line of the story was call Bobby Petrino a coward, label him a genius. He doesn't give a rip. He just wants to coach football was basically the theme of the story. Okay. He read that as me calling him a coward and got really, really pissed off about that and may have held a grudge for a little while. So, but I was not calling him a coward. I was just saying you can call him whatever you want. The guy just wants to coach football. So that's not a question that someone asks, but that is an example of a coach getting really pissed. What about you?
Bobby barked at me once, but that's not a very good story because I made a mistake. I used to cover Kansas. I used to work in Topeka, and I covered the couple of years when Mark Mangino was the coach. Now, his second year that I was there, the 2007 season, they went like 11-1, won the Orange Bowl, great year. The year before, I think they went 4-8, and they should have gone 11-1. There was only one game that they actually got beat. Every other game, they blew second-half leads, a lot like A&M last year, which got, Mike Sherman fired. And in the string of this losing second-half leads and losing games, I think they had lost three or four of those in a row. At his weekly press conference, I asked him something about, I don't remember exactly what I asked him, it's like, what's happening at halftime, what's not happening at halftime that these major adjustments either are or aren't being made and you're causing these losses? And he basically gave me a no answer, just a bunch of coach speak, said nothing. And before somebody else could ask, I jumped right back in and I asked him a follow-up, like, you know, you got to tell him, I don't remember what I said, just basically not letting him get away with a non-answer. And I have no qualms about saying Mark Mangino is a jerk. Like, I wish I could say a stronger word right now. He was a jerk to everybody all the time. And so I asked him this quick follow-up, and he said, you're speaking in generalities. You know, I'd love to sit down with you sometime and break down the film, but I don't have that kind of time. I've got things I got to be doing. You don't know what you're talking about, and blah, 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 blah. Well, they went 4-8. Yeah. So he could be mad all he wanted. He blew a ton of second-half leads in 2006.
Your Mark Mangino sounds a lot like the Saturday Night Live guys. Dup Bears.
Well, he was a large man. Yeah. He was about as close to spherical as you'll ever see a human being, maybe like Humpty Dumpty, and just a huge jerk, which was really interesting covering Kansas because I also covered Bill Self, their basketball coach, who literally couldn't be a better guy. Just super nice guy, would just love to shoot the breeze with the media, off the record all the time. He'd sit and eat lunch with us and whatnot, and Mangino, just total opposite. It was really weird.
Yeah, there's a reason Mangino is still looking for a coaching job.
He's a jerk.
I mean, there are probably a number of reasons he's still looking, but yeah, his demeanor is probably on the list. And it's great that you know, they have gone such polar opposites just 3 or 4 years later with Charlie Weiss.
Polar opposites, huh? That's I don't know. That's not the case. That is what we call on the spot. You don't have it on the spot for me, do you?
No, I had one and I lost it over the heated debate about whatever it is you said about Niles should have got hit in practice, but then he shouldn't get hit in games. Whatever nonsense that was, I just completely lost my on the spot for you.
Well, it's a segment we call on the spot. We'll do that every week, something where the other person does not know what's coming. You know, it's not always going to be about sports. In our practice run, I asked Chris about the first time he kissed a girl, and that was a funny story. But I already gave him that one, so I couldn't give him that one again. All right, Chris, we're touching up on 48-49 minutes here, so let's kind of wrap this up. As we do that, what is going to happen on Breaking Bad in this midseason finale?
My prediction is Hank either connects the dots that Walt is Heisenberg and the big meth cook, or there is something that very early in the next season leads to him connecting the dots. But I think Hank is very, very close to figuring out his brother-in-law is the meth mastermind of New Mexico.
No spoilers. We're not going to give spoilers. But my prediction is Skylar's going to do something crazy. Last week, she gave that Jesse that look, and it was just like, this is a woman on the brink of going nuts. If you're not watching Breaking Bad on AMC, and it's not because you have Dish and don't get AMC, stop what you're doing, get the DVDs, and watch it. it is a life-changing experience.
I would agree with that. And I just really quickly, to stop what you're doing, I thought you were about to launch into the Humpty Dance. Stop what you're doing, because I'm about to ruin the image and the style that you're used to.
If this was a video podcast, I would totally bust a move right now, but I don't want to do it with the listener not being able to see that, because then I'm just doing them an injustice to see my wicked awesome dance moves. Well, not see them, I should say.
You would probably be doing them a favor by not dancing on camera for them. And by the way, I just want to note, I don't think there's another media outlet that covers the Razorbacks where you're going to get a Humpty Dance reference. That's all.
That's what the show, Graham, brings to the table. And we hope you've enjoyed the show, Graham. And we're going to keep doing this every week for you. Again, hit us up on Twitter. I'm Adam_Alter, A-L-T-E-R. Chris is C-Bahn, C-B-A-H-N. We want to make this as good as we can for you, the listener. Again, it's sports radio at your leisure. Chris, as we're wrapping up here, tell us something the fans can look for in Arkansas Sports 360.
Well, obviously we'll have coverage of the Jacksonville State game this weekend, if we can call it a game. We'll have a lot of that going on. I'll have a preview of the game up on Friday by about noon. We like to get it up early because I know you folks like to get out of the office a little early on Fridays, you slackers. So I'll have it up. You can check it out on ArkansasSports360.com. I would also encourage you, while we're giving out Twitter handles, follow at ArkSports360. That's our official news feed. And we're on Facebook and, I don't know, maybe Pinterest and MySpace too.
Pinterest?
I think I just made that. You really think we're on?
You're not on Pinterest.
I'm not. We used to be on MySpace, by the way. You could still find back when MySpace was cool. I saw one of the freshman players last night tweet that he was about to join MySpace. I didn't realize
that's dangerous.
I didn't realize that even still existed.
I think that Chris Hansen just uses that to catch perps.
TCAP. But yeah, seriously, Facebook. We're on Facebook. ArkansasSports360.com at ArkSports360 on Twitter. What about you? What you got cooking at Razorback Nation?
We've got our preseason special Thursday night from 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock in the p.m. It's on KNWA Northwest Arkansas. It's on KARK in Central and Southern Arkansas. Really great stuff. We've got a ton of great content getting you ready for the season. Sit-down interviews with Tyler Wilson and Niall Davis. We've got great feature stories. I did a little something about Kiaro Small playing both ways. I have a great story about Braylon Mitchell balancing being a student-athlete and a father at a young age. My compatriot Trey Dare put together a great timeline piece, just, you know, chronicling everything that's happened, going back to the winning the Cotton Bowl leading up to today. So that's 7 to 8 on NBC here in Arkansas. Primed for a Championship is what it's called. And it's really good. Parting thoughts, anything?
No, I'm good. I'm just glad everybody joined us. I hope you'll get back with us next week and enjoy the show, Graham. Enjoy the week. Don't drink too much, and remember, cab fare is always, always, always less than bell money.
Wise words from Chris Bond. This has been the show, Graham. I'm Adam Alter. This is Chris Bond. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.